By now, he was able to test a new horse by galloping it over broken ground. If it fell, young Paul would land cat-like on his feet, shake his head with disapproval, and walk away. When hunting buffalo, he would mount facing his horse's tail, so as to have a steadier shot when the beasts chased his horse, as they invariably did. This unusual seat in no way hampered his control of the horse, and he could change to face ahead so swiftly and smoothly as not to upset his mount's stride in full gallop. About this time he showed a gift of extrasensory powers. Before a hunt, standing at his horse's head, he would go into a self-induced trance and begin describing the surrounding countryside and the wild animals in it.
1 hour's ride to the north there is a small muddy pan. A herd of quagga are drinking there, and 5 fat eland are coming down the path to the water. On the hill above it, under a camel-thorn tree, a pride of a lion are resting, an Oswat manhar, an old black maid and 2 lionesses. In the valleys beyond, 3 giraffe.
The hunters would find the animals, or the signs that they had left, exactly as young Paul described them. At 16 he was entitled, as a man, to ride off 2 farms, as much land as a horseman could encircle in a day. Each of them was approximately 16,000 acres. They were the first of the vast landholdings he acquired and held during his lifetime, sometimes bartering 16,000 acres of prime pasture for a plough or a bag of sugar. At 20 he was a field cornet, an elected office which was something between magistrate and sheriff. At such tender years, to be chosen by men who venerated age marked him as somebody unusual. About this time, he ran a foot race against a horseman on a picked steed over a course of a mile, and won by a length. Then, during a battle against the black chief Sekukuni, the Boer general was shot through the head and tumbled over the edge of the koppie. The general was a big bulky man, 240 pounds weight, but Paul Kruger leapt down the krantz, picked up the body, and ran back up the hillside under the musket fire of Sekukuni's men. When he set off to claim his bride, he found his way blocked by the wide Farl River, in raging spate, the carcasses of cattle and wild game rolling by in the flood. Despite cries of warning from the ferryman, and without even removing his boots, he urged his horse into the brown waters and swam across. Flooded rivers would not stop a man like Paul Kruger. After having fought Moshesh and Muzilikatsi, and every other warlike tribe south of the Limpopo River, after having burned Dr. David Livingstone's mission on the suspicion that he was supplying arms to the tribes, after having fought even his own people, the rebellious Boers of the Orange Free State, he was made Commandant-in-Chief of the Army, and still later, the President of the South African Republic. It was this indomitable, courageous, immensely physical, powerful, ugly, obstinate, devout and cantankerous old man, rich in land and herds, who now lifted his head from the Bible and finished his reading with a simple injunction to the men who waited upon him attentively.
"Fear God and distrust the English," he said, and closed the Bible.
Then, still without taking his bloodshot eyes from Ralph's face, he bellowed with shocking force,
"Bring coffee!"
And a coloured maid bustled in with a tin tray loaded with steaming mugs. The men around the table exchanged pouches of black Michalisberg shag and charged their pipes, watching Ralph with closed and guarded expressions. Once the oily blue smoke had veiled the air, Kruger spoke again.
"You asked to see me, Mynheer."
"Alone," said Ralph.
"These men I trust."
"Very well." They used Ditaal. Ralph knew that Kruger could speak English with some fluency, and that he would not do so as a matter of principle. Ralph had learned to speak Ditaal on the diamond diggings. It was the simplest of all European languages, suited to the everyday life of an uncomplicated society of hunters and farmers, though even they, for the purposes of political discussion or worship, fell back upon the sophistication of High Dutch. "My name is Ballantyne."
"I know who you are. Your father was the elephant hunter. A strong man, they say, and straight. But you..." And now a world of loathing entered the old man's voice. "You belong to that heathen, Rhodes." And though Ralph shook his head, he went on, "Do not think I have not heard his blasphemies. I know that when he was asked if he believed there was a god, he replied," and here he broke into heavily accented English for the first time, "I give God a 50-50 chance of existing." Kruger shook his head slowly. "He will pay for that one day, for the Lord has commanded, thou shalt not take my name in vain." "Perhaps that day of payment is already at hand," said Ralph softly, "and perhaps you are God's chosen instrument." "Do you dare to blaspheme also?" the old man demanded sharply. "No," Ralph shook his head. "I come to deliver the blasphemer into your hands." And he laid an envelope on the dark wood, then with a flick slid it down the length of the table until it lay in front of the president. "A list of the arms he has sent secretly into Johannesburg, and where they are held, the names of the rebels who intend to use them, the size and force of the commander gathered on your borders at Pitsani, the route they will take to join the rebels in Johannesburg, and the date on which they intend to ride." Every man at the table had stiffened with shock. Only the old man still puffed calmly at his pipe. He made no effort to touch the envelope. "Why do you come to me with this? When I see a thief about to break into a neighbour's home, I take it as my duty to warn him." Kruger removed the pipe from his mouth and flicked a spurt of yellow tobacco juice from the stem onto the dung floor beside his chair. "We are neighbours," Ralph explained. "We are white men living in Africa. We have a common destiny. We have many enemies, and one day we may be required to fight them together." Kruger's pipe gurgled softly, but nobody spoke again for fully 2 minutes, until Ralph broke the silence. "Very well, then," he said. "If Rhodes fails, I will make a great deal of money." Kruger sighed and nodded. "All right, now I believe you at last, for this is an Englishman's reason for treachery." And he picked up the envelope in his brown, gnarled old hand. "Goodbye, Mynheer," he said softly. Kathy had taken to her paint-box again. She had put it away when John was born, but now there was time for it once more. However, this time she was determined to make a more serious work of it, instead of sugary family portraits and pretty landscapes. She had begun a study of the trees of Rhodesia, and already had a considerable portfolio of them. First she painted the entire tree, making as many as 20 studies of typical specimens, before settling on a representative example. And then, to master painting, she added detailed drawings of the leaves, the flowers, and the fruits, which she rendered faithfully in watercolours. Finally, she pressed actual leaves and blooms and gathered the seeds, then wrote a detailed description of the plant. Very soon she had realised her own ignorance, and had written to Cape Town and London for books on botany, and for Linnaeus Systema Natura for plants. Using these, she was training herself to become a competent botanist. Already she had isolated 8 trees that had not been previously described, and she had named one for Ralph Terminalia Ralphi, and another for Jonathan, who had climbed to the upper branches to bring down its pretty pink flowers for her. When she diffidently sent some of her dried specimens and a folio of drawings to Sir Joseph Hooker at Kew Gardens, she received an encouraging letter, complimenting her on the standard of her artwork and confirming her classifications of the new species. With the letter was an autographed copy of his Genera Planetarium. Quote, "To a fellow student of nature's wonders," unquote. And it had become the start of a fascinating correspondence. The new hobby was one that could be practised side by side with John's bird-nesting activities, and it helped fill the dreary days when Ralph was away, although now she had difficulty keeping up with John, her swollen belly reducing her to an undignified waddle. She had to leave all the climbing and rock-scrambling to him. This morning they were working one of the kloofs of the hills above the camp, where they had found a beautiful spreading tree
with strange candelabra of fruit on the upper branches.
Jonathan was 20 feet above the ground, edging out to snatch a laden branch, when Kathy heard voices calling in the thick bush that clogged the mouth of the kloof. She swiftly rebuttoned her blouse and dropped her skirts down over her bare legs. The heat was oppressive in the confined gully between the hills, and she had been sitting on the bank and dabbling her feet in the trickle of the stream.
"Yoo-hoo!"
she yodeled, and the telegraph operator came sweating and scrambling up the steep side. He was a dismal shrimp of a man with a bald head and protruding eyes, but he was also one of Kathy's most fervent admirers. The arrival of a telegraph for her was an excuse for him to leave his hut and seek her out. He waited adoringly with his hat in his hands as she read the message. It read, "Passage reserved Union Castle, leaving Cape Town for London, March 20th, stop. Open envelope and follow instructions carefully, stop. Home soon, love, Ralph."
"Will you send a telegraph for me, Mr. Braithwaite?"
"Of course, Mrs. Ballantyne. It'll be a great pleasure." The little man blushed, like a girl, and hung his head bashfully. Kathy wrote out the message recalling Zuga Ballantyne to King's Lynn on a sheet of her sketch-pad, and Mr. Braithwaite clutched it to his concave chest like a holy talisman.
"Happy Christmas, Mrs. Ballantyne," he said,
and Kathy started. The days had gone by so swiftly she had not realised that the year 1895 was so far gone. Suddenly the prospect of Christmas alone in the wilderness, another Christmas without Ralph, appalled her.
"Happy Christmas, Mr. Braithwaite," she said,
hoping he would leave before she began to cry. Her pregnancy made her so weak and weepy. If only Ralph would come back. If only...
Pitsani was not a town, nor even a village. It was a single trading store standing forlornly in the flat sandveld on the edge of the Kalahari Desert that stretched away 1,500 miles into the west. However, it was only a few miles to the frontier of the Transvaal, but no fence nor border post marked the division. The country was so flat and featureless, and the scrub so low, that the rider could see the trading store from a distance of 7 miles, and around it, shimmering like ghosts in the heat mirage, the little cone-shaped white tents of an army encamped. The rider had pushed his horse mercilessly along the 30 miles from the railway at Mafeking, for he bore an urgent message. He was an unlikely choice for a peace messenger, for he was a soldier and a man of action. His name was Captain Maurice Heaney, a handsome man with dark hair and moustache and flashing eyes. He had served with Carrington's horse and the Bechuana police, and in the Matabele War he had commanded a troop of mounted infantry. He was a hawk, and he bore the message of a dove. The sentries picked his dust from 2 miles out, and there was a small bustle as the guard was called out. When Heaney trotted into the camp, all its senior officers were already gathered at the command tent, and Dr. Jamieson himself came forward to shake his hand and lead him into the tent where they were screened from curious eyes. Zuga Ballantyne poured Indian tonic onto a dram of gin and brought it to him.
"Sorry, Morris, this is not the Kimberley Club. I'm afraid we have no ice."
"I saw not you have saved my life." They knew each other well. Morris Heaney had been one of Ralph Ballantyne's and Harry Johnston's junior partners when they had contracted to bring the original pioneer column into Mashonaland. Heaney drank and wiped his moustache before looking up at John Willoughby and the little doctor. He was in a quandary as to whom he should address his message to, for although Willoughby was the regimental commander, and Zuga Ballantyne his second in command, and although Dr. Jamieson was officially only a civilian observer, they all knew with whom the ultimate decision-making and authority lay. Jamieson smoothed his embarrassment by ordering directly, "Well then, out with it, man."
"It's not good news, Dr. Jim. Mr. Rhodes is utterly determined that you must remain here until after the Reform Committee has captured Johannesburg."
"Well, when will that be?" Jamieson demanded bitterly. "Just look at these." He picked up a sheaf of telegraph flimsies from the camp table. "A new telegraph every few hours in Frank Rhodes's execrable code. Take this one yesterday, Jamieson read it aloud. Quote, "It is absolutely necessary to delay floating until company letterhead agreed upon." Jamieson dropped the telegraphs back on the table with disgust. This ridiculous quibbling over what flag to fly. Damn me, but if we weren't doing this for the Union Jack, then what are we doing it for? It is rather like the timorous bride who, having set the date, views the approach of the wedding day with delicious confusion, Zuger Ballantyne smiled. You must remember that our friends on the Reform Committee in Johannesburg are more used to stock deals and financial speculation than the use of steel. Like the blushing virgin, they may need a little judicial forcing.